The kids are gone, the hair is gray, and the gravity seems just a little greater, especially in the morning. Must be middle age. Time for midlife crisis? Maybe. One of the topics we'll cover in this hour is whether that's a real thing or a social construct. Our guest explored that and a whole lot more in her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Barbara Bradley Haggerty wrote it. She covered law and religion for the better part of two decades for NPR. Before her radio days, Barbara worked for the Christian Science Monitor. She has written a previous book, The Well-Received Fingerprints of God. Barbara, good to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Jeff.
So the first vignette in the book is just rather shocking. You were actually on the phone asking your doctor about a heart attack?
Yes. I was at NPR, and I'd gotten a rather angry email from someone who heard a story of mine. And suddenly I felt my heart kind of pounding and this pain radiating up the back, up my back. And so what did I do? Naturally, I Googled women and heart attack, right? That's what you always do. And it turns out I had several of the symptoms of a heart attack. So I called my doctor, and he said, you know, I don't like the shortness of breath. And while I was on the phone with him, I fainted and then found myself in an ER, and they were doing all of the tests and everything like that. And by the time I actually got to the ER, Jeff, I felt just fine. It was a momentary kind of stress-related thing. I don't know what it was, but I felt just fine. But I'll remember this one moment when I was trying to argue my way out of the ER so that they would let me go home. And the nurse looked at me, and she looked at the chart, and she said, you're 53, right? And I said, yes. And she goes, I think we'll keep you overnight. And it was like, oh, my goodness, 53 is like a clinical condition. But it kind of was. You know, it's middle life. It's middle age. Stuff can happen then. And in fact, one of the kind of really ironic and terribly sad things that happened is they kept me overnight that night. And while I was there, my dad died. And when I got out of the hospital, what hit me and hit everyone is that, you know, my brother as well, is that, oh, my goodness, my generation is the next to go. And it was this moment where I realized I need to take a hard look at life so that I'm not just letting it pass me by, or I'm not allowing myself to fall into doldrums. I need to take a hard look at this.
And you write about the mismatch between self-image and reality. I mean, having the nurse say you're 53, right, is one thing. But, I mean, when you look in the mirror, you're aware of that, I know, because we're just about the same age. But you,
right.
You don't feel that old inside. And that seems like a fairly common mismatch.
Yeah, it is. I mean, at that point, I was spinning every single day. Of course, the spinning came because I got arthritis in my right knee and I couldn't run anymore. But I was spinning. I was in terrific shape. And here I am. But, you know, you look in the mirror and you see your mom, essentially. And you go, oh, my goodness, how did that happen? And there's also, I think, almost a career or psychological mismatch that comes with employment. At least it did for me. And that mismatch was, you and I are in a career which is very, very demanding and news-oriented. And in my younger self, my 30-something self, or even early 40-something self, wanted to chase after every story and pull an all-nighter. And I did a lot of that as the Justice Department correspondent for NPR during 9/11. But, you know, my 50-something self kind of preferred a good night's sleep to pulling an all-nighter. And I realized there was this disconnect from where I thought my ambitions should be. And those are proper ambitions when you're, say, in your 30s, 20s, 30s, early 40s, and where my ambitions, my true ambitions were now, which is not so much to lay back and take it easy, but just to repurpose what I was good at and see if I could do it in a more sustainable way. So maybe long-form narrative as opposed to just lots of breaking news, that kind of thing. And so I was also grappling with a mismatch as to my career, what I thought my career aspirations should be, and what they really were.
I'm sorry to hear about your dad dying the night you were in the hospital. But, you know, you have some interesting things to say about him, and his approach to the last chapter of his life was quite robust.
Oh, it was. It was. I mean, the last few years were hard because he did get Alzheimer's or he got dementia. But until then, he lived the most engaged life. So this is a man who started his own company and would get up in the middle of the night around 2 o'clock in the morning and study French for, an hour every night, study vocabulary, and then he would come back to bed and go to sleep, right? This is a man who was terrible at French, but he felt like he really wanted to learn how to do it, how to speak French, and so he could travel around France with his family on business trips and things and actually speak to people. And so here's a man who kind of wasn't particularly good at something but thought it was well worth doing, and he spent time. He learned how to swing dance at age 88, I believe it is. So this is a man who really lived life to its fullest, and he was a great model for me.
And what was it he said about learning French? It's even if you do it badly, it's better than not knowing it at all, or something along those lines?
That's right. Yeah, what his view was that some things are worth doing badly. And what he meant by that is just because you're not going to be an Olympic cyclist, Barb, when I took up cycling, that doesn't mean that you can't do cycling and really enjoy it. It's worth doing. Even if you're not going to win all the gold cups and all the medals and everything, even if you're not going to be fluent in French, it's worth learning because you like it. And it gives you something, it gives you goals and victories and accomplishments as you learn more and more words. It's worth doing. And I took that to heart.
So one of the major issues before we move on is the terminology here. I know my wife and I have gotten into a few conversations about this because she's the one who always says, how is 53 midlife?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a really great point. Let's think of 45 to 65 as a middle section of your life.
Okay.
So kind of a section. Yeah, I don't expect to live to be 100, 112, which is what I would be if this were precisely in the middle of my life. And in fact, midlife is a relatively recent phenomenon because in the 1900s, people didn't live much past 40. Their midlife crisis was, they were dead, right? And so this is a new, relatively new phenomenon with our longevity. But she's absolutely right. 53 is not in the middle of your life, but it's in a middle section.
I appreciate the projection if I actually get to live to be 106, but probably not. So anyway, we'll talk more with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about her book, Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. When we come back to the Jefferson Exchange, you're more than welcome to join us with your phone calls and emails. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the former NPR correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty, who's written a second book, this one about midlife in America. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. It pulls a bunch of things together, some science, neuroscience, all the other things that are officially about what's going on with us, and then a lot of the societal attitudes as well, and some great personal stories. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So obviously a couple of different approaches going on here. We mentioned the science just now and the sense of attitudes about midlife. And you say that midlife gets a bit of a bum rap. How is it often viewed?
Yeah, it's often viewed as this really kind of terrible time of life. And that's because of this myth of the midlife crisis, where the whole idea arose in the 1960s from a really obscure journal article called Death in the Midlife Crisis. And it was based on a study of a few men, and it was later picked up by Daniel Levinson at Yale, and he studied a few men, 40 men, and Levinson concluded that 80% of all men, it was always men that he studied, 80% of all men have a midlife crisis. And what happened, and then Gail Sheehy picked it up and wrote passages, and by then, we're off to the races, right? We've got American Beauty, and we've got all the stereotypes. Well, when researchers came back in the 1990s and said, yeah, let's really look at how common this thing is, what they found is only about 10% of people have what's called a classic midlife crisis, which is the sense that, life is passing you by, that you'll never be able to achieve your dreams and aspirations by the time you die. It's a grasping at youth, that it's an angst-filled time. And most people don't feel that. Now, Let me tell you what they do feel, Jeff. They do feel in their 40s and 50s a low point in happiness. And this is pretty universal. I think of it as midlife ennui. So people in their 20s and 30s are relatively happy, but their happiness level is going down. And it hits a low point in your 40s and 50s. In America, the low point is 45. It's 40 for women and 50 for men. And then what happens, it's like a U-curve of happiness. Then what happens is after you kind of reach your early 50s, you begin to climb back up that U-curve, and you get happier and happier and happier right through your 70s. And so people who say that they are feeling blue, they're feeling down in their 40s or 50s, they're not delusional. They are feeling something. But generally what they're feeling is the weight of responsibility. It's realizing that, yeah, you know, their dreams of becoming a CEO or a pitcher for the Nationals, I'm in Washington, D.C.,
or the
Mets.
That's
never going to happen. Yeah, that's never going to happen. And they have a lot of responsibilities at work, and they're taking care of kids and aging parents, and they have mortgages and college tuition. It's a burdensome time. And so people aren't feeling giddy with happiness. What they are feeling, though, is meaningful. They feel their lives are meaningful. And as some of those burdens decrease, like kids go off, and as they begin to re-envision what they think is important in their 50s, what happens is they get happier and happier. So it's a great story.
And there are three themes that run throughout the book, as you point out to us. One, engage with verve. Two, your thinking is your experience. And three, choose purpose over happiness. And I want to make sure we focus on this one first, because I don't want people to misunderstand. You're not talking about not trying to be happy, but you're talking about,
right,
about going about it a slightly different way.
That's right. That's right. So there's this idea that Aristotle talked about, which is eudaimonia, or the good life. And the good life, he said, was not, you know, a good meal or a temporary thing, a good meal or, you know, a good ski run down the ski slope or something like that. I'm not sure he talked about that. But that is not the good life. That's hedonia. That's hedonism, which isn't bad. Everyone should do these things. I mean, they're great to do. But he said what is really important to do is live with your eye to the long game. So it's not about immediate happiness. It's about making the investments in things that matter. It's about raising children, which is not immediately gratifying, but later it is. It's about the hard work that comes from training for the Olympics or training for a marathon. It's not easy or happy in the moment, but in the long term, it's got purpose, it's got striving, you're doing something that's long term. And that, when I say choose purpose over happiness, that's what I am talking about, having your eye on the long game. And, you know, it's interesting because science has really shown that purpose is very good for your health. I mean, people who live purposeful lives, they keep their memories intact longer, they're less likely to have heart attacks, they live longer. I mean, purposeful living is very, very healthy.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about midlife. Her book on the subject is called Life Reimagined. So technically, scientifically, is there a midlife crisis? I mean, you mentioned a lot of these studies, and you underscored it yourself already, that men got a lot of the study. But, I mean, is there such a thing technically?
I mean, people would say yes, there is. And they would say that about 10% of the population does have this sense of angst about aging. In fact, what NPR did was they sent out a call out on its Facebook page, and the call out was, how is midlife treating you? And we got about 700 responses in about 2 or 3 hours. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And I read through all those emails. They were beautiful little masterpieces about midlife. By far, the majority, vast majority, were people who were happy. It didn't mean they didn't have challenges, but they were very happy. There were a handful, and I would stress a handful, where there was a real existential angst about aging. A woman who just felt that her looks were going, that she hadn't really achieved what she wanted to achieve. Another woman who quit her job because she, after reading Eat, Pray, Love, because she felt she'd lost her smile. So there were some of these, in midlife crises, but they were really, really very uncommon things.
Did you find many stories of people not doing what they hoped to be doing at this point in their life?
Absolutely. And what happened with those people is they tended to be really happy. So what would happen? I'm sorry, Jeff. What they would do is there was a man who wrote me who was a chef, who wanted to be a chef. And what he realized was that a chef's life really wasn't compatible with having a family and kids. And being a starving chef in New York, he wasn't sure he'd make it. So he became, you know, he became someone who sold chef's equipment and manufacturing equipment and all of that. And he had a very good life. He was delighted. He wasn't doing exactly what he thought he would be doing, but he had a family, he had children he cherished. He was as happy as a clam. There was another woman who thought she'd be an actress and graduated from acting school. Turns out doesn't make it as an actress. She gets her PhD and she runs lung cancer trials. She is so happy. And she says, you know, if I told my 20-something self that this is what I'd be doing, she would slit her wrists, you know, no doubt with some kind of wonderful monologue about, you know, an unused life being a bad one, or, you know, accomplishments not coming true and how tragic that is. But she ended up being really, really happy with her life. She had family, she had a husband, she had kids, she had a good career. Yeah, she wasn't an actress, but, you know, who cares? She was happy.
Enter the Great Recession, and how badly did this batter people who are currently in midlife, or were in midlife at the time it started?
Yeah, you know, this was the great question mark, because academic research takes a little while to get up to speed. By the time you do your research and get it published in a peer-reviewed article and all of that, it takes a while. So a lot of the research had not captured the devastation of the Great Recession. I saw this a lot in the emails I received and the people I talked to. This was by far the largest trigger to what people thought was a midlife crisis. In fact, it was more like a crisis in midlife. Midlife is full of crises. You lose your job, you lose your spouse, you lose your parent, you know, you have a health scare, something like that. Generally, though, what happens is once the crisis is either averted or you take steps to try to fix it, or you come to terms with it, your set point of happiness goes back to where it was before. And in fact, that's what I found, Jeff, because I kept in touch with a lot of these people who are so distraught about losing their jobs and not being able to find another one. And there were a lot. I kept in touch with them over 3 years. And almost to a person, they all found jobs and they were happy. So this really proved what I was hoping was true, was that people who kind of get stable again and get back in the workplace and all of that, they return to their former chipper selves, and that is precisely what happened. But there is no doubt, I'm not going to say that this is an easy time for a midlifer. It is hard to find a job if you've lost it in midlife these days. But the people I talked with generally had and were generally happy.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty is a former NBR correspondent, so her voice should sound familiar to you. She is the author of a book on midlife called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. There's some fascinating stuff in here as we get into the scientific section of the book, or at least the study section of it. The Longevity Project is one that really kind of stands out. What was that about?
Yeah, there's been a couple of long-term or longitudinal studies that look at people over a lifetime. So they follow people, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years. They survey them, and this is one of them, and there's another one out of Harvard, too. They survey them every few years. They do interviews, things like that. And they look at what is it that makes you happy and thrive over the course of a lifetime. So people who were, they started studying them in the 1930s. Who thrived during their lives? And what they found, the biggest predictor of lifetime success and happiness was not education, it wasn't IQ, it wasn't wealth, it wasn't any of those things. It was social network. It was whether you had friends and family you cared about. And that was precisely the conclusion of the Harvard study, too. The Harvard study followed four classes of Harvard men beginning in 1939 and interviewed them every few years, and long interviews. And they realized at the end, I mean, many of these men lived into their 90s and are still living. What they realized is the biggest predictor, as one researcher put it, the biggest predictor is happiness is love, full stop. That was the biggest predictor of doing well. There was another predictor, too, though, if I can just mention,
sure,
because I think it's so important, and that is engagement. I was talking to another one of the researchers. There are two major researchers on this project. And he said the people who are engaged and the people who invest outward and not inward were the happiest. So by that, he means, and it's actually a hallmark of a healthy midlife. Eric Erickson, the psychologist, talked about the middle years being ones that are generative, meaning you invest in the next generation or outward into your community or other causes. But you're not accumulating for yourself. This isn't about getting more cars or a larger house or, you know, greater, better job. It's about investing outward. And that the people who are really happy were the ones who are able to pivot at some time during their midlife and say, you know what, this life isn't all about me. I want to start investing in younger people and in causes that I care about. And those people remained engaged because their world did not shrink to a pinprick. Their world enlarged as they went on in years, which is very, you know, you think of getting older as your world getting smaller. But if you invest outward, your world continues to grow. And those were the people who flourished.
So more than anything else, it sounds like you have to avoid being sidelined or feeling like you're sidelined because you're not doing anything useful anymore and you're not meeting new people. Those are the things that really sound like they make a huge difference.
Right. Right. They do make a huge difference. And, you know, in midlife, sometimes we do feel like we're being sidelined. I mean, there's a lot of discontent in the workplace in the United States, according to Gallup, where it shows that something like one out of five baby boomers and Gen Xers, or close to that, are actively disengaged with their work. And the reason is basically is that they feel they are being sidelined. They see the opportunities going to younger people who probably are more tech savvy than they are. They feel that they're not growing, they're not being challenged. They feel that they can't leave this job. They're trapped because they have family responsibilities. And it's a source of great discontentment. But at the same time, what's going on is there's a whole rethinking about one's career and one's purpose. There's something called the Encore Movement right now going on, which is how do you use your experience and your skills and your wisdom for the greater good? So how do you pivot on those things that you're good at in your job, for example, and start to pivot and use those talents and those skills more and more? So, I mean, a simple example would be if you don't want to leave your job, but perhaps you feel you can mentor younger employees. What that does is it gives them your wisdom and it gets you in the game where they are, you know, teaching you the technology. So it's kind of a win-win. How do you think about what you can contribute that's unique to your talents and your skills and your passions and do that in the workplace? Sometimes it means volunteering. Sometimes it means changing jobs, but it doesn't have to. You can avoid being sidelined simply by engaging with other people at work.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book on midlife is called Life Reimagined. So when we get to the part about needing to be engaged and have people around you as you go through midlife, there's one part of this that just sounds like going to Dr. Frankenstein's lab. You were being shocked in an MRI at the University of Virginia. That's a great story.
Yes, it was a little bit traumatic, I must say. So what happened is there is research that shows that friends are very important, and the way you look at the world differs from when if you are facing kind of the threat with a friend or with no one or with a stranger. So what happened is I went down to the University of Virginia with my very close friend, Sheree Harder, and what they did is they put an anklet on me, and that anklet would give me electric shocks at random times. They slid me into the brain scanner, and I would look up at a screen, and if I'd see a red X, what that meant is I had a 20% chance of getting shocked, and it hurt. It really, really hurt. I've got
not
to tell
just
you.
A little, not
and then,
just
and then
your feet.
No, it was not a small shock. And then if I saw an O, that meant I was on the screen. That meant I was in the clear. Well, they tried it with three different conditions. One is when I was alone and facing the shock, the red X. Another when I was holding the hand of a stranger, an engineer, and the other when I was holding Sheree's hand. And this is what happened. When I was with a stranger or alone, my brain, the fear centers of my brain lit up like a Christmas tree. It was like all full fight or flight mode, right? Panic, 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 run, run, run. When I faced the threat holding Sheree's hand, my brain was completely calm. It was as if there was not a threat at all. It was a stunning, and this is really common. I mean, this is, they've done this study on hundreds of people, and they find this over and over again. When you are with someone trusted, it's as if the threat, it's no longer a threat. It's just something that you deal with because your friend is going to help you deal with that threat. You offload the stress onto your friend, and you work through it together. And if I may give you one analogy that they told me, which I really love. So, you know, 10,000 years ago, your ancestor was walking through the forest alone, and suddenly comes face-to-face with a bear. Well, his fear centers are going nuts. Run, 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 run. You know, get out of there. Okay. He's walking through, and then he looks, he sees a bear, but then he sees that there's another, a man from a neighboring tribe nearby. And so his brain is a little bit calmer because now he doesn't have to outrun the bear. He just has to outrun the other tribesmen, right? And then he's safe. But if he is with his hunting buddy, the bear is no longer a threat. The bear is tonight's dinner. That's how what friends do for you. They calm you and they help you face the threat of the world.
Okay, I wondered about whether you're going to get to the point of I just have to run faster than the other person. We did indeed get there, but for reasons that were well explained. Barbara Bradley Haggerty will come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more about her book, Life Reimagined. You can join us by phone or by email. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is a broadcasting pro of many years. Barbara Bradley Haggerty worked as a law and religion correspondent for the better part of two decades for NPR. She's now written a couple of books. One, her most recent one, is about midlife itself. Her book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we compare notes about what midlife actually means to people and how we can feel like it's one of the better parts of life. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the importance of engagement of friends, of people close to you. As you go through anything in life, really. Are there differences, though? Because I've found this really interesting in the book. Some differences between how our brains perceive friends and family members at midlife.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, really interesting finding. So some of the friendship research suggests that actually friends may be better for your health and your brain long term than family is. And the reason is that friends are actually disposable, right? If you have a friend that's causing you a whole lot of stress, raising your cortisol levels and everything else, you tend to back away from that friendship. You don't always, and I'm not suggesting that you drop all your friends who give you, you know, trouble, because friendships go through ebbs and flows. But still, if a friend is causing you a lot of stress, you end up basically moving away from that relationship. You can't do that with family, right? I mean, you're not going to just because, and I love my in-laws, but just because if I didn't, I couldn't back away from my in-laws simply because I wanted to. No, they would actually continue to be a source of stress for me because I'm married and these are relationships that I must maintain. So it's really pretty interesting literature about how important friendship is and that it may, in fact, be more important than families.
You know, speaking of families, we talked about the fact that while you were in the hospital with what at first appeared to be a heart attack and apparently was not, your father died, but you also had been thinking about midlife before that trip to the hospital because your mother had a stroke, actually a series of them.
Yes, yes. And I was thinking about that because my mom really was my best, and she's still alive. She's doing great. But she was my best friend, and her kind of singular gift was her ability to articulate ideas, help me solve dilemmas. She was just a wonderful person. And when she had a stroke and fell unconscious for several days, and we simply weren't sure that she would ever come out of it. We weren't sure she would ever speak again. And this, for me, was a real tragedy. It actually triggered what I thought was a midlife crisis, because I remember, you know, coming home after a few days at the ICU, and my mom still hadn't spoken, and really awakened very much. And I remember it was a beautiful day, and I looked outside, and it was spring, and it was green, and it was my favorite time of year, and I felt nothing. I felt nothing but flatness and sadness, like, oh, gosh, is this it? And I looked at my husband, and I said, I think I'm having a midlife crisis. And he said, don't do that. Please don't have a midlife crisis.
Thanks for the support, pal.
Right. Yeah, don't do that. And so I started to do the research instead, and that's really where the book, you know, that's how the book came about. Can I tell you one story about how Mom came out of this, how we knew she was going to be okay?
Sure.
And this really goes to something that's pivotal, that's really important about midlife. So Mom is in she's moved to the stroke unit. She becomes conscious, but she can't speak, and she doesn't know what words are and things like that. So one morning, it's Memorial Day morning, she is in the stroke unit, and the neurologist comes in trailed by a number of students, and the neurologist says, Mrs. Bradley, I just want to do a couple of tests. Do you mind looking out the window there? What are those green things on the trees that you see outside? And my mom looked out, and she looked a little worried, and she shrugged, and she couldn't say. She said, that's okay, Mrs. Bradley. How about, see those things going down the street? What do you call those? And Mom looked at the cars, and she shrugged, and she didn't know. And my brother said, ask her what her favorite Sunday morning talk show is. And the neurologist said, Mrs. Bradley, what's your favorite Sunday morning talk show? And Mom said, Freed Zakaria, GPS, the first words that she had spoken, right?
Uh-huh.
But what the insight here about Mom is that Mom wasn't particularly interested in gardening. She wasn't interested in driving in cars because she didn't drive anymore. She was immensely interested in current events. She reads the New York Times and the Washington Post every day. She's addicted to CNN. I never argue with her on policy issues because she always has like the more nuanced argument, right? She is really, really smart on these things. So if you ask her about what engages her, like the Arab Spring at that time, she will come right out with what engages her, Freed Zakaria, GPS. And then we knew that she was going to be okay. We knew that there were words in there and that her mind was working. And it was just a matter of time, a few weeks before she really got back to completely 100%. And I think the reason she's 100%, in fact, the therapist told me this, is because she was engaged in life. She was forward-looking. She was talking about seeing her kids and going to Nantucket this summer, and not many 89-year-olds do that. She looked forward, and she looked at life with relish. And that is a real secret to midlife.
And she certainly had some curiosity. I love the conversation, even later still after she fell and broke her hip, when she asked you to explain quantum mechanics to her one morning.
Okay. Yes, I walk in, and here's my mom, and she's like prepared for me. She's waiting for me to come, and she says, honey, could you please explain quantum mechanics? And I'm like, all right. I said, well, Mom, I can tell you a little bit about quantum physics. And she said, no. I said quantum mechanics. I said, well, Mom, I'm not sure I know the difference, but they're in the same zip code, so let me explain what I know. And I sat there and explained what I knew about quantum mechanics. She had read a reference to it in an article she had read, and she really just wanted to understand it, and I explained it. And she's hanging on for dear life. Here she is. At this point, she's like 90, 92, 93. She is listening so hard. She's scrunching up her eyes, but she gets it. At the end of the line, she understands what quantum mechanics is. Isn't that great?
It truly is, and it gives the rest of us hope. So now those of us who have misplaced our keys or walked down the street looking for the hat that we'd already put away in the drawer, true story.
Yes.
So our memory is going to decline at this age. I mean, just the nerve cells themselves are getting a little worn out, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, there's good news and bad news, but there's more good news than bad news. The bad news is after around age 30, this type of intelligence called fluid intelligence, or your ability to solve novel problems quickly, you know, the speed of your brain, your processing brain speed, all of that stuff begins to decline, okay? And the connections weaken and all of that. You forget where you put your keys. You forget that while you're frantically looking for your iPhone, you're actually talking on it, right? I did that, too. so you forget these things. But then, on the other hand, this other type of intelligence called crystallized intelligence, which is all the stuff you scoop up in a lifetime, your knowledge, your experience, your expertise, what you read in the New York Times, what you learn, you know, how you conduct radio interviews, all of that stuff grows and grows and grows right into your 70s. And what's true at midlife is it's actually the sweet spot for your brain capacity, because your fluid intelligence, your processing speed and all that have not declined that much, but your crystallized intelligence, your wisdom, your experience, your expertise, all that has increased so much. And so you are at this perfect time of competence. And it's why, like, it's why if you have a choice between a 30-year-old surgeon, no offense to you 30-year-old surgeons out there, and a 50-year-old surgeon, you pick the 50-year-old. Why? Because he, when something goes wrong, he or she has seen it before and knows what to do on the operating table. And that's who you want. You want the experienced person, not necessarily the fastest person.
So you spent some time apparently hanging out with memory championship contestants?
Yes, I did.
And what kinds
of... And oh my gosh, it's incredible what they can do. They can memorize a deck of cards in like 53 seconds. When I went to the memory championship, and what I was interested in was the middle-aged memory championship contestants, not the young ones.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they're really at a disadvantage because the memory championship focuses on things that are really good when you're young, like speed and memory, memorizing lots of things. But what is remarkable is when you look at these middle-aged people, they can remember, memorize a deck of cards in a minute. They can study names and faces and then be given, you know, just the faces and write down the names of, 100 people. It is absolutely unbelievable what they could do. I watched one man at a conference who asked people just to name different objects or different ideas, you know, like toothpick or chandelier or bicycle race or whatever. He asked them to do that. They called out 20 different things. He didn't write them down. And then 20 minutes later, he recited them forward, backwards, and backwards every other one. Right? The human brain is unbelievable. And this guy was 56.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's unbelievable what people can do in midlife. It is just, it's a stunning little computer that we've got in our head.
We talked about the NBAC game that you reference in here that you worked on a while back with Joshua Foer, who wrote the book Moonwalking with Einstein. He entered the memory championship and then won it.
So then won it.
Yeah. So how does the NBAC work?
Well, what the NBAC does is it tries to increase your working memory. So it helps you learn how to juggle, kind of remember things. So, you know, you see a blue square lights up, and then another blue square lights up, and then another one. Well, it's a blue square that lit up this time. Is it the same one, in the same position as the one that lit up last time? Or is it in a different position? So you do that. That's called a one back if it's the time before. And what you do is you do a two back, a three back, a four back. Is that English castle that I'm seeing the same English castle that I saw five castles ago? It gets really, really hard. But what happens is you become relatively mentally agile. You begin to be able to juggle things in your head. And I did this for 20 days, and I was absolutely shocked what happened. So were the researchers, by the way.
Really?
I did all these cognitive tests one day in April, and I felt like I was like walking through water. I felt so slow. All of these really, I hate standardized tests anyway. This is like my nightmare. It really was. And, you know, you may begin, right? It just doesn't that strike fear in your heart? And then I did this NBAC and practiced for 20 days, and I came back, and I had, on all my cognitive tests, an 18% improvement. But on the kind of gold standard fluid intelligence test, right? Remember fluid intelligence?
Yeah.
I improved by 75%.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, when I was doing those tests, it's called the Raven's test, when I was doing that test, it felt as if time had slowed down and I was able to spend more time on each problem. And so instead of only finishing half the problems, I finished all of them and only made a couple of mistakes. That is what that training did for me. So it was actually a really stunning result. But if I can just say this one thing, Researchers do not say that you should, the way to improve your brain is to sit in front of a computer and do these brain training exercises. Even the researchers who gave me these tests would not say that. The best thing you can do for your brain is to do something novel that you really enjoy. So if you like crossword puzzles, but you're already good at them, don't do crossword puzzles. Learn Spanish and or play the guitar or do something that's novel and challenging and that you enjoy. And the other thing you can do, actually kind of the magic bullet, so to speak, is you can exercise. There is nothing that is better for your brain, nothing, than exercise.
Really?
I began cycling. Mm-hmm. Nothing better. It's unbelievable what it does. It actually rolls, but it actually makes your brain younger by a couple of years. Even mild exercise 3 times a week will actually turn back the memory clock.
30 minutes a day, enough to get your heart rate up, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's like 40 minutes a day for 3 days a week, mm-hmm. enough to get your heart rate up. And what they have found in plenty of tests is that it increases the part of your brain that's critical to memory and learning new things, which is the hippocampus. It increases that. It keeps new brain cells alive so that instead of just dying off, you actually keep these new brain cells. It's fabulous for your brain. There is really nothing you can do that's better.
Is there one thing above all others, Barbara, that really stuck with you when you were done with the work that led to Life Reimagined?
Yes, there is. When I started this book, I have to tell you, Jeff, I was pretty kind of depressed about the rest of my life. And what was crazy is I had a great life. You know, I had a good marriage. I had a good job. I have a great stepdaughter. I had my health. I mean, everything was good. And yet I felt so flat, like life was just going to be boring. And what I found in the course of this research is that as I engaged, as I took myself off autopilot, because autopilot is a way to have a serious midlife funk. You know, if you take things for granted like your marriage, your health, your everything, you're going to have a problem with midlife. When I engaged, I became so much happier, and now I am as happy as I've ever been, truly.
There's lots of great stuff in here. The book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Barbara Bradley Haggerty wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Barbara, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.